Wisconsin is home to many wonderful native plants, and we're going to be talking to our next guest about how to choose the best ones for your garden. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network and spending some time with us. On the phone with us today, Uli Lorimer. He is the Director of Horticulture for the Native Plant Trust in Massachusetts. We'll talk about how to choose natives for your yard and the environment. You'll also have some tips on how to shop for plants and questions to ask before you buy. We'll also take your questions, of course. What would you like to know about selecting native plants? You want to know more about protecting natives? Join in. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Uli Lorimer, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us on this Earth Day.
Thank you so much, Larry. I'm glad to have the chance to speak with you today.
Let's talk about the Native Plant Trust. It was the first plant conservation organization in the U.S., if I'm not mistaken. How did it get started?
It was started back in close to 1900 by a group of botanists and local gardeners here in Massachusetts. Recognizing even at that time they were seeing habitat loss and things that used to be much more common were growing less common. And so they kind of banded together to start an organization that was originally called the New England Wildflower Preservation Society. Their aims were, like the name said, to try to conserve and preserve as much of the natural diversity in the region as possible.
Hmm. Has it changed much over the years, or how has it changed, if anything?
Well, we've changed our name a little bit, Native Plant Trust is only sort of about a year old. After we were previously known as the New England Wildflower Society since probably the early 70s up until last year. And so in terms of what we do as an organization, that really hasn't changed, just a new name that's a little easier to say, and we feel is a little more encompassing of all of the different aspects of what our organization does.
And I think there are similar organizations around the country or throughout the country. I'm probably a lot of them used your organization as a sort of a model.
Yeah, I mean, so what, since we are a conservation organization, one of the things we have sort of I like to think of it as three legs of a stool that all support our mission, which is to conserve New England's flora. And those three legs are obviously plant conservation, public programming. So this is all of our educational outreach, our advocacy, and public horticulture. And so we have a display garden, we sell retail plants, and we try to sort of promote all of our messaging through having a beautiful garden that people can come and visit and a place where people can come and buy plants.
Yeah.
The conservation program is something that we're really proud of because it's a program where we've been able to bring together all of the federal, state, and local partners and conservation organizations and getting everybody at the table so that we can all share resources and come up with sort of conservation priorities and targets. And that sort of approach is what is being copied in other parts of the country because people realize it's much more effective to have all of the people who need to be in the same room to get them into the same room so that you can share resources. And you may be surprised it actually is a lot harder than you think to get all those folks in the same room and to get them to talk nicely to one another.
Different groups that may have different priorities, I suppose, and it sometimes it's hard to meld them all together, I would bet.
Yes. Yeah, no, certainly. And there's a lot of, I wouldn't say competing interests, but, who has authority over certain things. And, you have to build trust so that, all of the partners feel like everybody's working in the best interest of our clients, which are the plants.
You oversee the Garden in the Woods Botanic Garden in Framingham, Massachusetts. Talk about that.
Sure. So Garden in the Woods was originally the property of one of the earlier founders of Native Plant Trust, a man named William Curtis. It's a 45-acre property that had previously been owned by a railroad company that was mining it for sand. And it's a fairly unique property. It's a land that shows the evidence of our last ice age. So there's sort of a plateau on the top, which is a big pile of sand, and then we have some naturally occurring wetlands that go through the sort of two-thirds of the property. And so we've got a lot of microclimates and a lot of unique little situations where we can grow a wide variety of native plants.
And so this, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that you know, it's been continuously developed since the mid-1940s as a botanic garden. So there's some really wonderful displays and things that are really only possible because folks have been looking after it for decades now.
Yeah, man.
Very special place.
And I know listeners are going to want to learn more about it. How do we do that?
Well, I mean, if any of your listeners are in the Massachusetts area, of course, we would love to have you come and see the garden in person. Short of that, we have loads of resources and lots of things that you can explore on our website, which is www.nativeplanttrust.org. And there's lots of different drop-down menus and links, and you get a real sense of all of the work that we do.
Yeah. Tell us about raising giant silk moths.
Yeah, so this was kind of an ongoing project that we had a volunteer who was really into silk moths, and he thought, hey, you know, the garden would be a great place to connect visitors with these increasingly unusual uncommon organisms and the host plants that they need to survive, and so. We raise Cecropia moths and Baltimore checker spots, which is actually a butterfly. And what we do is we overwinter the cocoons. We have them outside in a protected place so they can go through all of the environmental cues of being outside. And then we have a little cage set up where they can emerge as adults. They can mate. And we can collect the eggs, and then as the eggs hatch, we, you know, literally hand feed them their host plant leaves. and then as they get older, then they get actually put out into the garden on their host plants, along with a little bit of interpretation and sort of a mesh bag to make sure that the birds don't ruin our hard work. And so people can come through and kind of make that connection that, you know, let's say if you want to have a Cecropia moth, you need to have black cherry or sassafras, for example, in your garden in hopes of attracting these organisms. And it's a great way, again, you know, these are things that few people encounter. So it's a really wonderful way to make those connections.
It sounds just wonderful. Chris from Adams wondered how you deal with pesticides and herbicides that are killing pollinators.
Well, you know, we at the gardens, we don't use any pesticides whatsoever in our operations and management of the gardens. And it's actually something that we're also really proud of that we do in our retail plant operation. And we also do a lot of contract growing. We don't use any pesticides whatsoever. And I think, you know, kind of jumping ahead a little bit, you know, one of the things that is really important for people to ask when you're shopping for plants is to find out whether they were produced with pesticides or not. And if your nursery can't really tell you, then maybe you need to take your dollar somewhere else where you can be sure that you're not buying a plant that's been treated with, let's say, a neonicotinoid or something that may end up poisoning or killing your pollinators, the very things that you're wanting to attract.
Yeah, absolutely. Uli Lorimer, Director of Horticulture for the Native Plant Trust in Massachusetts. And we're going to get into some more of the details about native plants and what to look for and how you should purchase or not purchase those plants as we visit with him. So it's great to have him with us. He again directs the horticulture for the Native Plant Trust in Massachusetts and will be with us right up until about 12:30 today on the Ideas Network. Just wanted to say a big thank you to everyone who donated during our spring member drive. Support from people like Lisa and Madison sustains the news and information you value on our Ideas Network. And to ensure the resources are in place, we fundraise throughout the year, and we've been doing this for a long time. If you missed the drive that we just had, your gift right now at WPR.org is especially important. That's WPR.org. Thank you so much for contributing, and please do stay with us. We'll be back with Uli Lorimer right after this look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us on this Earth Day. I'm Larry Mueller. Happy to have you with us today. Our guest is Uli Lorimer. He is Director of Horticulture for the Native Plant Trust in Massachusetts. So what would you like to know about plant trusts? Do you have questions about how you can help native plants or just questions about native plants for your own home or area? I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, Uli, we had an email from someone listening in. It was kind of a specific question. Man, I bet you might have some advice for him. What is he has a, it's Todd in Delavan. He has a west-facing mm-hmm. garden and a small hill that's about 12 by 35 feet. He has salvia, coneflowers, grasses, and would like to add some color and also attract pollinators. So any suggestions for Todd?
Sure. Well, there's two. First of all, I would say plant milkweeds. There's a crisis going on with our monarch butterflies, these very charismatic insects that migrate from one particular place in Mexico and sort of fan out into the United States. And it comes from the fact that they don't have enough milkweeds to rear successive generations. And so the more milkweeds people can plant, the more food there will be for these really wonderful organisms. And if you have a good sunny and kind of it sounds like this gentleman's yard would be perfectly suited for our butterfly milkweed, Asclepias tuberosa, which has a wonderful orange blossom, is fairly well behaved in smaller gardens. There are other common milkweeds which can be a little more aggressive for smaller spaces, so I would recommend our butterfly milkweed as a good choice. And then secondly, I would say consider planting spotted horse mint, Monarda punctata. It also likes dry soils, sunny exposure, and is a real sort of pollinator powerhouse for all sorts of other kinds of things, for bees, for bumblebees, wasps, different kinds of butterflies. You can't go wrong with spotted horse mint.
And that mint as opposed to other mints, which are a bit more aggressive?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, spotted horse mint, if it's happy, it may seed around a little bit, but it's not going to grow through rhizomes and be as aggressive as some of the culinary mints that sometimes people plant thinking it would be great to have some mint to use, and then you can never get rid of it again.
Yes. I know some folks who have had experience with that, but this sounds great. So spotted horse mint.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Let's take some calls here. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. And before we do take calls, are there plants that you would recommend sort of in general for us in Wisconsin?
Well, the two that I mentioned, I think, are really good choices for sunnier areas. And then I wanted to also really recommend people plant oak trees. There's a number of really wonderful oaks that are native to Wisconsin, white oak, black oak, red oak, bur oak, just to name a few. They're really wonderful, long-lived trees. And they support a whole host of organisms and insects. They're shelter, they're food for lots of things, they provide shade, and they're just, there's something sort of regal about a nice old oak tree that, you know, even if you're planting it young now, think about it for maybe your kids or your grandkids to enjoy when they get older.
Plant
oak trees as many as you can.
I'm kind of with you on that. I love oaks. Mary in La Crosse has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hi. My question is about the plant Nicotiana. I used to plant a lot of them in my container gardens because they were easy to grow and they were pretty. And I know nicotine is poisonous, but just having the plant, was that bad for the insects?
No, the insects actually aren't as affected by the nicotine as we are in humans. Nicotine actually, as a chemical, has an effect on our neurological system, which it does not have for many insects. And so you haven't really done any harm in that sense by having those in your yard.
Okay, there you go, Mary. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. What are some of your favorite spring natives, Uli?
Well, you know, for me, the spring ephemerals are particularly something that I cherish. You know, these are plants that only show up in a brief period of time, hence the name being ephemeral. And they come up now sort of, you know, April into May, and they bloom before the tree canopy fills out, and then they disappear. And then you have to wait a whole nother year to see them again. So these are things like bloodroot, like trilliums, like trout lilies, Dutchman's breeches. They're just really wonderful, charming little plants, and kind of they for me are a sign of that spring is coming, and they kind of embody all of the wonderful positive things that we associate with spring, with new beginnings and a revival of nature, and they just bring a smile to my face whenever I see them.
John in Chippewa Falls, let's go to you now. Hi, John.
Yeah. Hi, I got a question about, I have a nice south-facing lawn, a lot of maple trees, sugar maples, and, you know, it's pretty shaded during the summer, so it looks terrible right now, but is there anything I can grow under there?
Are there natives that work under there, Uli?
Yeah, sure. So one of the things that you could consider doing is potentially transitioning some of the lawn that's directly under the trees to sedges. And sedges are actually can make a really attractive lawn alternative because they don't need to be mowed very often, and they are particularly drought tolerant and shade tolerant. One of the other things you can do, and this is a plant that is not particularly widespread in Wisconsin, but a plant called bluettes. Getting those established will give you it's almost like a dusting of snow on your lawn in the springtime. And there's lots and lots of little tiny little white flowers. And sort of a way to think of your lawn as just not being a monoculture of grasses, but to add some little diversity to it. Violets are another group that come to mind. They're fairly unassuming, and they'll give you a little splash of color in the springtime. And they're certainly hardy enough to withstand the drought and shade that comes when those sugar maples leaf out.
Yeah, good advice there. John, thank you so much for calling. Let's take another call. Ted in Spooner, it's your turn. Hi, Ted.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, what can we do for you? Yes.
Well, on my property line, I threw down a bunch of acorns for oaks to grow, and I planted a couple pine trees. And the neighbor farmer sprays, and it oversprays, and he kills the oaks right away. Mm. And I try to talk to the county people, and nobody does anything. How can I fix that?
Well, I mean, I don't know if there's a way to go to the township officials and or if you can talk to the neighbor directly and ask him to, you know, maybe be a little bit more careful when he sprays to make sure that it doesn't, you know, these applications aren't being done on windier days because of the drift that's coming over. You know, and again, I don't know. I would probably recommend to try the friendly approach and speak to him before you go and get the township involved. It's irresponsible to apply pesticides and then have them drift to, a non-target organism, because you aren't paying attention. Aside from that, you know, don't give up throwing down those acorns. Eventually some of them are going to take, and hopefully you can have some beautiful trees there in the future.
Ted, thank you so much for calling. You can join in to 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Cal from Sugar Camp couldn't stay online, but wanted to know or ask about Polyphemus moths and what their host plants are.
That one I don't know offhand, but we'll see if I can give it a quick internet search here and see if I can come up with that one for you. Let's see. They like oaks. They like willows and maples and birch.
Okay, so tree lovers.
They like trees. Yet another reason to plant oaks. There's lots of different willows. They're also great for lots of other organisms, and certainly birch trees are also really going to help out.
All right, there we go. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. There are a lot of things that I think we can talk about today. What do you think about the kind of challenges in the environment that we have with the changing environment, the challenges faced by native plants today?
Well, you know, the climate change certainly is one of the bigger, sort of more recent challenges to come up. And there's actually some pretty interesting data emerging that sometimes it challenges the assumption that plants are just moving northward as things get warmer, and that part of climate change is not just the environment growing warmer, but some parts of the country getting wetter and others drier. And so there's a really neat report out that has tracked tree seedling recruitment over 40 years in the Northeast and in the central parts of the United States. And it's actually showing that some trees are moving westward in addition to moving northward. And so you're going to have this sort of shift in dominant tree canopy and the plant communities that are associated with it, sort of on the macro scale. And then I think things like habitat loss and fragmentation and non-native invasive species are the other really big challenges to natives now, particularly invasive plants. And this is, I think, a place where folks can really take action on a much smaller scale And that starts with removing invasives on their property and replanting with appropriate native plants. Mm-hmm. It's a really good direct thing that you can do. And, you know, that sort of coupled with the idea that your garden doesn't just exist in a bubble. It's part of a larger landscape. And the more that we can connect our backyards together with more native plants, the more we can begin to heal and sort of reverse these trends on a regional scale. So, you know, battling invasives, I think, is something that is you know, and I'm not going to say it's easy to do because it's a lot of hard work, but at least it's something that you can make an effort on, whereas climate change is a lot harder to try to reverse. And that's not really anything that anybody on an individual scale can tackle.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about this. Many plants have been growing here for hundreds of years here in Wisconsin, yes. But they're not necessarily considered native. How is native defined?
Well, it's a good question. So native is how we define what is native in the Northeast. We look at what are called the ecoregions maps that the EPA puts out. And so we don't necessarily define natives by political boundaries because plants don't distribute themselves that way. They are distributed based on, you know, soil type and hydrology and underlying geology. And so those features on the landscape often expand into multiple political entities as they exist. And so looking at them as ecoregions can help you define an area that is native. And our approach is that if you're going to use plants, native plants, you should try to source them from within that ecoregion. And the reason is that these plants are ones that have adapted and evolved over, you know, many, many, many generations to the conditions in Wisconsin. And so they're best adapted to the climate there, and they're also in tune with all of the other life that relies upon them. And so this is a really important aspect that there's this, you know, very carefully choreographed dance every year where plants emerge and then their insects emerge with them, and then they begin to rear their young, and then the birds come in to eat the caterpillars, and it all just sort of snowballs together. And in order to keep that dance alive and thriving, you have to use the plants that are from that place. And that's kind of the core of this concept of regionalism, that it's the same if you were gardening in the Southeast, if you're, let's say you're in Arizona, or if you're in Wisconsin, or if you're in Massachusetts, the same principles apply. It's just looking at, you know, what ecoregions are near you and how do I select my plants from within that ecoregion.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. Monica from Monona, Wisconsin, wanted to know about the pros and cons of removal versus treatment for emerald ash borer.
Hmm.
You have that problem out in Massachusetts, I bet, emerald ash borer.
Yeah, it's beginning to make more inroads here. Well, you know, the safest thing to do is to remove dead trees, and, you know, treating them, the options for treating them are systemic insecticides. And my concern with the use of those is that there's a lot of collateral damage. There are other non-target insects that feed on ash that would also suffer if you make the entire tree poisonous for any insect to eat. Now, you have to then weigh that with, you know, if this is a really important tree to you, you know, what will it look like if I remove it? And do I have the, you know, can I replant it with something else? And so I think that's, you know, it almost becomes an individual choice. But I would just counsel people to think about that, you know, if you're going to use a pesticide or an insecticide for emerald ash borer, that you're likely also going to end up affecting a lot of other kinds of insects.
Yeah. Ray from Shatek called, and he was calling about the caller who was asking about overspraying, killing his oaks. And Ray says the caller should call the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection because they regulate overspraying in the state. And that's probably not a bad idea after, I think after talking with the farmer, if there's not a remedy, the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection does oversee this sort of thing for the state of Wisconsin.
So that's very good advice.
Yeah, I think that's a very good advice. So what are you doing to celebrate Earth Day?
Well, like a lot of organizations, we are closed to the public right now, you know, because of the pandemic. So we are trying to push celebration of our wildflowers online and through all of our social media outlets. And you know, I'm just trying to share with our members and the public some of the things that are happening out in the garden right now. You know, it's normally we have sort of a tree giveaway, and we have other sorts of bigger events for people to come and celebrate being outside and to celebrate the spring wildflowers, but that's just not possible this year. And so, you know, like many other organizations, we've turned to a digital facsimile, which is the best we can do.
Well, Uli, I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it, and I hope people here in Wisconsin have a chance, if nothing else, to go online and take a look at Garden in the Woods and learn more about the Native Plant Trust in Massachusetts. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much, Larry. I really appreciate speaking with you and with all of your callers and listeners. Thanks again.
Thank you so much. And speaking of thanks, I want a big thanks to those who donated during our spring member drive. Support from people like Jim and Menominee sustain all the news and information you get from the Ideas Network. And if you haven't given during our fun drive, I hope you'll consider doing it right now. Your gift at WPR.org is especially important during these times. Just go to WPR.org and make your contribution. And certainly in advance, thanks for that and for doing that. And thank you very much for listening. And I hope you'll stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.